Malian singer Khaira Arbi in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to President Trump's escalating war on Harvard University and academia as a whole. On Friday, a federal judge temporarily blocked a move by the Trump administration to bar Harvard from enrolling international students. They make up well over a quarter of Harvard's student body. A hearing on the case will be held today. On Monday, Trump threatened to redirect $3 billion in federal grants from Harvard to trade school. CNN is reporting trade schools. CNN is reporting the Trump administration is also poised to cancel $100 million in federal contracts with Harvard University. On Monday, Trump slammed Harvard for accepting so many international students and for not handing over detailed personal information about them.
Part of the problem with Harvard is that there are about 31%, almost 31% of foreigners coming to Harvard. We give them billions of dollars, which is ridiculous. We have Americans that want to go there and to other places, and they can't go there because you have 31% foreign. Now, no foreign government contributes money to Harvard. We do. So why are they doing so many? Number one. Number two, we want a list of those foreign students, and we'll find out whether or not they're okay. Many will be okay, I assume. And I assume with Harvard, many will be bad. And then the other thing is they're very anti-Semitic.
President Trump's escalating his threats as Harvard resists requests by the federal government to hand over detailed personal information about its international students. On Monday, Trump wrote on Truth Social, the information is needed to determine, quote, how many radicalized lunatics, troublemakers all, should not be let back into our country, unquote. On Monday, Democracy Now! Reached Francesco Anselmetti, a British-Italian international graduate student in Harvard's joint PhD program in History and Middle East Studies. He's a member of Harvard's Graduate Student Union. He responded to Trump's threats.
Trump's revocation of Harvard's ability to enroll and register international students is, of course, it's an attack on Harvard's international community. It's also seemingly one of the largest, perhaps the largest, threat of mass deportation on a unionized workforce in American history. I mean, this is an attack on American academia as it is an attack on American labor. Around 25% of the university's community, including around 4,000 workers, many of whom do the bulk of teaching at Harvard, many of whom, you know, despite a federal judge blocking the Trump administration's action, are left in a position of extreme precarity and uncertainty over the short and medium-term future. We expect, you know, Harvard to continue fighting for its international students in the courts, but we expect them to do so also in part because it's in their interest, right? What we aren't so sure about is whether it is in their interest to truly stand up for the free speech and intellectual autonomy it claims to be defending. In order for it to do so, it would have to seriously consider the claims of various student groups that have been operating on campus over the last 2 years in solidarity with Palestinian rights, groups which Harvard has had really no trouble in disciplining, in some cases banning. And the irony here is that, of course, these decisions from Harvard have represent caving to outside pressures, right? These, in many cases, have been decisions that Harvard has been pressured to do in response to right-wing groups, in response to donors who represent, you know, interests that want to eradicate any pro-Palestine sentiment on American university campuses.
That was Harvard graduate student Francesco Ansamethi speaking to Democracy Now! Harvard's UAW unions have condemned the Trump administration attacks on graduate student workers. We're joined now by Allison Frank Johnson, a professor of history at Harvard University, the chair of the German department. She's also a member of the American Association of University Professors, the AAUP. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Professor. If you can start off by talking about what Trump is demanding, what exactly this means as students who are in Cambridge and are around the world, not knowing whether they are being forced to leave as we speak.
That's right. This is these measures are targeting not only the students who haven't arrived yet, who've been admitted, but are still at home packing, planning to go to college, to start their doctoral programs, but also students that are well into programs they've already started. Some of them supposed to graduate on Thursday, the day after tomorrow. Some of them 6 years into a 7-year PhD program. Some of them freshmen and sophomores at college. Even before these latest measures targeting international students, F1 and J1 visa holders were announced, we had already seen the harassment of international students and scholars coming into the United States. I know many international students who were afraid to go and do research, to go to archives, to go accept collaborative grant offers from other universities, which actually do and many times fund research that is being done at Harvard, afraid to leave the country because they didn't know if they'd be let back in even before this was happening. So this is a massive escalation, but it's not the beginning of the attacks on the embeddedness of the research that we do in a global community.
And Professor, we had a segment last week about talking about how the European Union, Canada, the UK, even Australia have been increasing the amount of money that they're devoting to scientific research, hoping to lure Americans who are now being targeted by this war on science of the Trump administration. Could you talk the discussions you've been having with your colleagues about whether some of them are considering leaving, going to other countries, and what the long-term impact on America's lead in science and technology and research would be as a result of this?
Absolutely. So I'm a historian of modern European history. Three scholars in my field who work at Yale recently very publicly announced that they were leaving for Canada. So far, my colleagues at Harvard and I are trying to prevent that from happening. So our focus right now is to try to work together to ensure that Harvard continues to be a place where people will want to and be able to do cutting edge research. And so we are not yet planning for this mass exodus, but we're aware that that is one potential outcome, one we very much want to avoid. The work being done at Harvard, where grants have been cut, in fact, I think today the Trump administration announced they were cutting all contracts and all grants with Harvard University, that affects people working on tuberculosis, on ALS, on soft robotics, on diabetes, obviously on cancer, repairing eye damage, people working on doing things like translating the Dead Sea Scrolls. That work has already been done, reducing school absenteeism. This is useful research. It's useful to any country that will host it. And in fact, it's useful to the whole world, no matter where it takes place. So I understand that there will be attempts to poach some of the best scholars that we have at the university. Although, as I said, my colleagues and I right now are trying to, that's not the outcome that we want. We don't want to see people get well-paying jobs and fellowship opportunities elsewhere. We want to save this university.
And could you talk about the range of demands that the Trump administration has made of Harvard in relation to these foreign students, what exactly they want, the information they want?
Well, for better or for worse, it's not entirely clear what they want. I think what they want is to destroy Harvard University as a way of destroying independent research and scholarship that they can't control, intimidating the other universities that they haven't yet targeted by destroying Harvard. So whatever Harvard does, it's not going to be sufficient. You heard from the graduate student that you already interviewed that the university has actually taken many of the steps that the Trump administration has requested and demanded, including dismissing the director of the Center for Middle East Studies, including providing lots of information about our international students and accepting a definition of anti-Semitism that the regime favors. They also provided all legally required information related to the visa program that is being canceled, you know, SCVIP. They did that. So when the Trump administration says that they haven't provided the information that's required, it's not clear what exactly it is that Harvard even legally could provide that they still want. So Harvard does have an obligation to protect the privacy of its students, I think to a lesser extent of its employees, but certainly of its students. It can't just divulge anything to anyone. The federal government is the entity that has issued every single one of these students their visas. So presumably they already have access to the names and countries of origin of all of the students whose visas they have approved. I think that whatever their demands are, and they certainly extend beyond what the law requires, even if Harvard were to meet them, they would come up with a new set of demands that it hadn't met. It's very clear that what they want to do is run the university into the ground.
Before we go, I wanted to ask you two quick questions. You talked about some of the grants and what would be shut down. What about the grants around scientific research? I mean, you have the situation where the Harvard School of Public Health, apparently, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that they are cutting funding for the School of Public Health, laying off people, also reducing graduate student admissions. What about other schools? And also Trump's comments when he says, we're still waiting for the foreign student list from Harvard, as you point out. They already have the list, because they give them the visas. They know who's there, unless they want much more personal information. But Trump says, so that we can determine after a ridiculous expenditure of billions of dollars how many radicalized lunatics, troublemakers all, should not be let back into our country. What this means, not only for your school, but for the universities around the country.
Yes, I think that Harvard is being made of an example of, but Harvard is not really the target here. It's the independent scholarship that's being produced by universities, universities that work also to solve medical problems that aren't very profitable, universities that are answerable to the truth and to future generations rather than to shareholders. And those universities do things like work on cures for cancer and work on cures for tuberculosis and work on cures for diabetes. And that work is obviously it's obviously essential. But we also do things like talk about climate change, right? We also do things like talk about the impact of income inequality. We also do things like talk about the importance of recognizing people's identities, their sexual and gender-based identities, for their own mental health. We also talk about things like the segment that you aired before about what's happening right now in Gaza. And those messages, whether it's that vaccines work or that there is human-caused climate change, or that we need to attend to the terrible tragedy that's occurring in the Middle East, are messages that the administration doesn't like, right? Universities, not only Harvard, do this work because they care about the truth. They don't just care about what's politically expedient for the current administration. And I think that the assertion that the administration should decide which students are allowed to come to Harvard, which scholars are allowed to come to Harvard, whose ideas are dangerous to whom, right? Dangerous to an administration that isn't interested in admitting that vaccines work, that isn't interested in admitting that there's climate change, that we should be reducing our dependency on fossil fuels. Dangerous to an administration whose foreign policy seems to run on friendships with bullies. That's the kind of control that they want to have. And Harvard can't let them have it because we won't be the last one they try to get it from.
Alison Frank Johnson, we want to thank you for being with us. We'll follow what happens with the hearing today and beyond, not only at Harvard, but at schools all over the country right now. Professor of History at Harvard University, chair of the German department, speaking to us from Munich, Germany. She's also a member of the American Association of University Professors. Up next, we go to Georgia, where a pregnant woman who's been declared brain dead has been kept on life support for over 3 months against the wishes of her family because of Georgia's six-week abortion ban. Back in 30 seconds. Martin, they're marching down the street. Yeah. I see somebody marching. They're marching down the street. Oh, yes, they are. Streets, performed by Zeeshan B in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Georgia, where there's growing concern about the plight of a pregnant woman who's been declared brain dead but has been kept on life support for 3 months against the wishes of her distraught family because of Georgia's abortion ban. Adriana Smith is a 30-year-old mother and nurse who suffered a medical emergency in February due to blood clots in the brain, was declared legally dead. At that point, she was about 9 weeks pregnant. She's now about 22 weeks pregnant, but doctors have kept her on breathing machines because her fetus was old enough to have detectable cardiac activity. Georgia's heartbeat law bans abortions after a fetal heartbeat is detected. This comes as Georgia's attorney general said Georgia's heartbeat bill does not require medical professionals to keep a woman on life support after brain death and issued a terse statement that, quote, removing life support is not an action with the purpose to terminate a pregnancy. Georgia's maternal and infant mortality rates are among the worst in the country, with black women dying at twice the rate of white women. We're joined now by two guests. In Washington, D.C., Mini Timuraju is with us, president of Reproductive Freedom for All, formerly NARAL Pro-Choice America. And in Atlanta, we're joined by Monica Simpson, executive director of Sister Song, the National Woman of Color Reproductive Justice Collective that's based in Georgia, has a lawsuit against Georgia, arguing its six-week abortion bans denying people in Georgia life-saving care. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Monica Simpson, let's begin with you. Can you talk about this situation right now, what the family wants for their beloved brain-dead loved one who is pregnant and who doctors are keeping on life support?
Thank you so much for having me. It is a dire situation that we're dealing with here in Georgia, and we are constantly having to navigate this system that keeps showing us over and over again that it is deadly to be Black and pregnant in this state where access to care is so far out of reach for so many people, and the limitations and the criminalization that we are constantly navigating now with this abortion ban is something that Georgians did not want, and it's something that we are constantly doing all that we can to push back against. Adriana deserved to be here. What we know about her story is that she did what she knew what to do as a nurse. When she found out and she could feel in her own body that something was wrong, she went to the doctor. She went to get the care that she needed, and she was sent home. Now, if the doctors would have did everything they could, maybe we would have been able to get a different outcome for Adriana. But unfortunately, that's not what happened, because unfortunately, that's not what happens for so many Black women in this country. They are not trusted when they are going into their doctor's offices. They're not trusted when they are saying that there's something wrong with their bodies. They're not trusted when they are saying that they need access to care. And unfortunately, that's what happened to Adriana. And so now her family is battling such a hard time. They should be able to grieve. They should be able to take care of themselves and all of the family members who are having to deal with this ordeal. But unfortunately, they're having to navigate so many unanswered questions. They're having to navigate something they shouldn't have to, which is an abortion ban that's connected to this issue that should not even be at play at this particular moment.
And in Georgia, we're talking about one of the states that has among the worst maternal and infant mortality rates in the country, particularly for African-American women and children. Could you talk about that?
Absolutely. We are dealing in Georgia with maternal health deserts, right? Over half of our counties do not have access to an OBGYN. So care is out of reach for so many. We are also a state that is yet to expand Medicaid. And we know federally, we are still fighting for Medicaid to be something that Americans have access to, which means that there are thousands of people upon thousands of people who are falling in the cracks every single day, not having access to basic health care needs. So when you add that to a state that has now put a 6-week abortion ban in place, it makes it a very, very harsh environment for folks to be able to get access to what they need in terms of their reproductive health care.
I mean, it is amazing. Georgia's Attorney General, Chris Carr, released a statement declaring that the 6-week abortion ban doesn't require medical professionals to keep women alive on life support after they've been declared brain dead. Monica.
What I find very interesting about the times that we are in is that this abortion ban has created so many obstacles for people. There has been too many people who have tried to figure out what it means, when it means that. And that is the problem that we're dealing with here. It is not cut and dry. It is not black and white. It is something that we're having to constantly navigate over and over again. At the end of last year, we lost 2 more Black women because of what this abortion ban put in place for them in terms of a barrier. We lost Amber Nicole Thurman and Candy Miller, right? These are 2 Black women who were also pregnant in our state that wanted to terminate a pregnancy and came up against the very real barriers that this abortion ban puts in place for folks. And so what is happening constantly as we are getting these stories, as we're understanding what the landscape is really looking like for people in Georgia because this abortion ban is in place, is that it is not a cut and dry. And we're not getting cut and dry answers here. We are dealing with folks who are in real time having to navigate too many questions whenever it should be that we should have access to the real time health care that we need in order for us to be able to thrive and to live our most healthy lives in Georgia. And that is not the case with this abortion ban that is currently in place.
I want to bring Mini Timuraju into this conversation and relate it to what's going on nationally. President Trump's so-called big, beautiful bill that many call just a tax break for billionaires squeaked by in the House, now is in the Senate for a vote on reconciliation bill that would defund hundreds of, among other abortion care clinics, Planned Parenthood clinics. A last-minute addition Thursday would ban Affordable Care Act health care plans from covering abortion. Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez slammed the bill Wednesday ahead of the vote. This is what she said.
I want people to understand, for my Republican colleagues who assure what is in and not in this bill, in this process that has been this rushed, when you wake up in the morning, you will realize that you voted to defund Planned Parenthood and to take away health care from 13.7 million Americans. And when this country wakes up in the morning, there will be consequences to pay for this. And I yield back.
That's AOC. I want to bring in Mini Timuraju, president of Reproductive Freedom for All, formerly known as NARAL. You've launched a series of TV ads targeting key senators ahead of the vote on this budget bill. In light of what's happening now in Georgia, the 6-week ban, give us the map of the country and what this budget bill means.
Thanks, Amy. And thank you, Monica, for her incredible work and her team, not just in Georgia, but across the country. You know, we've got 21 states with extreme abortion bans and restrictions. You layer on top of that, this is the post-Dobbs reality, right? The map. In these states like Georgia, by the way, I want to mention Brian Kemp and Chris Carr, they disbanded their statewide maternal mortality, maternal health review commission, and they stopped issuing public reports. So you've got this perfect storm across the country of 21 21 states where they've banned abortion. They've already shut down critical health care systems and clinics, and they've already created this chaotic situation like we're seeing in Georgia and in my home state of Texas. Then you talk about gutting Medicaid and potentially defunding Planned Parenthood. That would also impact clinics in blue states. And this is really important because these blue states have been absorbing the patients. These are states that have Democratic majorities, super majorities, Democratic governors and AGs, where they've been boosting up and plussing up, stockpiling mifepristone, medication abortion, telemedicine services, clinic infrastructure in the states. But they would be gutted as well. Many of them receive Medicaid, or they fall under the provision that you mentioned that would disconnect abortion care from Medicaid and Medicaid services. So we're talking about completely dismantling family planning and abortion care services nationwide at a time where we know we already have a maternal health crisis that particularly impacts women of color. But we also have clinics across the country being attacked and patients who need that critical care trying to travel from states with bans to other states, particularly the blue states. So we are literally walking ourselves into Congress is literally walking us into a crisis of forced birth when we have Medicaid services that cover the majority in many parts of this country of births, prenatal care, and postpartum care. And it's unconscionable, and it is deliberate, and it is by design.
And Minnie Tamaraju, what specifically in this so-called big, beautiful bill in terms of the cuts will affect, especially when it comes to Medicaid, the poorest of our citizens?
I mean, look, the bill that came out of the House decimates Medicaid. It cuts significant funding to provide tax breaks for billionaires. There's a couple of things that are going to immediately happen. You're going to see clinics. Planned Parenthood estimates 200 of their clinics that provide not just abortion care, but also general family planning services. That's prenatal care. That's postpartum care. That's cancer screenings. That's STI screenings. That's well woman visits. In many places, it's general primary health care and the safety net for health care for many Americans, not just women, but all families. They're estimating 200 clinics to close nationwide should this bill go down, should this bill pass the Senate. In addition, you've got hospital systems lobbying against this bill. You've got insurance providers lobbying against this bill because this bill would also just decimate healthcare infrastructure well beyond family planning services. When that happens, the poorest of Americans who need these services, but also a lot of Americans who are getting these services who might not realize when they go to Planned Parenthood and they get the subsidized care, it's actually Medicaid, are going to be forced into our nation's ERs. They're going to be forced into other clinics. They may not get care at all. And that will have a dramatic impact on all Americans, regardless of where you get their health care, because it will decimate the larger health care system.
We only have 20 seconds. How are you fighting back?
We are lobbying aggressively the U.S. Senate. We are, as you know, we've launched these ads. We are organizing on the ground. We're working with partners like Monica and her team in Georgia. And we will be making sure Americans in those states realize that come 2026, if they've decimated Medicaid, there will be hell to pay.
Minnie Tamaraju, president of Reproductive Freedom for All, and Monica Simpson, executive director of Sister Song. That does it for our show. We're hiring a senior headline news producer, a director of audience, and a director of technology. To find out about all three jobs, go to democracynow.org/jobs. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Is that a normal part of your
segment? That's the way I've always sung. This is my song.
Are there subliminal duets?
Absolutely not.
The Metal Meltdown, a show that brings you melody-driven heavy metal from around the world. Melting your ears every Monday night from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.